Good morning. So to recap, last time mostly talked about a time-dependent harmonic oscillator in ordinary quantum mechanics under the conditions that the frequency approached a constant at early times, and the system was in its ground state. Started out in the ground state of a harmonic oscillator with constant frequency omega zero at early times. And we solved this system just by working out and this is something that's sort of, I think, in the category of things that are obvious in hindsight, that a really nice simple way to solve this system is to write down the Heisenberg picture operators as a function of time, where the u here that appears here, this is what's called the mode function. It's just the coefficient of the lowering operator. It's just, you could compute it by just integrating a classical differential equation. The classical equation of motion. With the initial conditions that at early times when it's a time-independent oscillator and the mode function is just going undergoing simple harmonic motion, that the normalization is 2 omega naught to the minus 1 half. And you really need quantum mechanics to get that normalization. And so based on this solution, you can easily compute anything. For example, let me call it the power spectrum. The expectation value of x squared at time t. That just by evaluating it in the Heisenberg picture is the absolute square of u. A sort of deeper fact here that's sort of hidden here is that all wave functions are Gaussian. We showed that the wave function being Gaussian is equivalent to the statement that it's annihilated by a linear combination of x and p. And that's true in the initial conditions, since you're annihilated by the lowering operator, which is a linear combination of x and p. And then because the equations of motion are linear, there's just some linear combination of x and p given by evolving the equations of motion, which is always annihilating the state. All right, and then we were sort of graduating to a field theory example, namely a massless test scalar in De Sitter. Where the action is to write it down covariantly. And so in Fourier space, so two field definitions are useful. There's sort of the natural field phi, where we wrote the action this way. And the canonically normalized field, or the we just change variables to get rid of the 1 over h tau squared in front of the phi dot squared term in the action. And the price you pay for that is you end up with this funny time dependence in the frequency. There's a term proportional to 1 over tau squared. And this is just the field definition, psi equals phi over h tau. All right, now, one advantage of writing things down in a canonically normalized way is that the choice of vacuum state is intuitive. Each degree of freedom, each Fourier mode, psi k, just behaves as a classical oscillator that satisfies these conditions. So there's a sort of clearly defined vacuum state where for every Fourier mode k, the mode psi k is in its quantum mechanical ground state. And that's what's called the Bunch-Davies vacuum. So I'm going to assume that this field starts out in the Bunch-Davies vacuum, which just means that every psi k is in its quantum mechanical ground state. So it's easy to write down the solution to this free field theory, just using the intuition that every psi k behaves like a classical degree of freedom as we had before. And the solution is, let me write that out. Oh, by the way, one piece of notation before I write that down. I'm working in conformal time here, and I'm going to stick with conformal time for a while until I go back to talking about inflation and the Einstein's equations. So just so it's not notationally confusing, let me use the following notation. If an over dot means derivative with respect to proper time, and a prime means derivative with respect to conformal time. So it'll be all primes today, I think. Okay. So the solution to this free field theory is really simple to write down. It's just, let me write it down for the canonically normalized field. So for every Fourier mode K, we have a corresponding Heisenberg picture operator, which looks like this. Let me write the mode function as u sub psi. So it's u times a lowering operator k, and then to make this operator is not Hermitian. Its Hermitian conjugate is psi minus k. So as usual in field theory, the second term is a minus k dagger. And likewise for psi dot, psi prime. I just differentiate. Where the u here satisfies the classical equation of motion. It's down tau squared. Another thing we know that really comes from the quantum mechanics is that we know the normalization of this mode function at early times. We know it has to go like 2k to the minus 1 half e to the minus ik tau as tau goes to minus infinity.
Curvature that is mathematically consistent, whatever that means. I mean, like, it's not that straightforward, right, to do a Fourier transformation on an arbitrarily curved background, right?
In these coordinates. I see what you mean. And there are contexts where I definitely agree with that statement. But all I'm doing here is just doing a coordinate Fourier transform. I just have the action written out in some set of coordinates. There are no perturbations to worry about. So I've just written down the action in some choice of coordinate system X. And then I just can always mathematically take the Fourier transform in that coordinate system. That's defined irrespective of anything else that's going on, like the fact that there's curvature in the metric.
The question is if these functions have a finite inner product, right? So if there are L2 or something like this on this background, square integrable over this manifold, because it has this weird 1 over h tau conformal factor, which may blow up somewhere. So the question is it well-defined to do this kind of Fourier transformation in the first place?
I suppose you might worry about whether their
expectation values stay finite or something like that.
If it's well-defined, then there would be some kind of unphysical observation, maybe. I mean, observable. Some kind of expectation value that may blow up. Because the tau went from, what is the range of the tau, and it went to the...
One thing that always mixes me up a little bit is that tau is... In this coordinate system, tau is negative. Yeah, I suppose you would get into trouble if you tried to talk about what was happening at tau equals zero. This Fourier transform is just taken one time. Here's one way to say it, I guess. The Fourier transform is just taken one time slice at a time. And so at a given time slice, this is just some finite conformal factor sitting in front of it. There's no spatial dependence. Okay. So you can check. I sort of made the leap from quantum mechanics to field theory by writing down this solution. But you can check if you want that if I just posit this solution as an ansatz, then it solves the free QFT in the sense that the Heisenberg picture equations of motion are satisfied and that the canonical commutators are equal to I if I, have the usual rule for if these raising and lowering operators satisfy the usual commutation relation. Okay. So it's useful to know. So this differential equation is the equation of motion for the classical equation of motion for one Fourier mode of a scalar field on de Sitter. And it's useful to know that this has an analytic solution. So it's useful to know that equation star has an analytic solution. And this comes up in all sorts of early universe calculations. And here it is. Of course, it's easy to check that this satisfies the classical equation of motion. Let me mention that this analytic solution is actually kind of hard to find. If we divide differential equations in three types, into three categories, there are differential equations that are solvable through some sort of systematic intuitive procedure. And then there are differential equations that can't be solved analytically. And then there's sort of an in-between category where you have to look in the scary Russian books that are full of solutions to weird differential equations. Or the 21st century equivalent is you just feed it to Mathematica and see if Mathematica can spit out the answer. It's like the modern day version of the scary Russian book. I think this is actually sort of in the scary Russian book category. And just to convince you of that, if you change the coefficient here from a 2 to a 2 minus epsilon. Then the solution is that u is proportional to tau to the 1/2 times h nu of k tau, where h is a Hankel function of non-integer order, nu equals square root of 9/4 minus epsilon. This also comes up, by the way, with the minus epsilon. This is what you would get if you worked out the classical equation of motion for a test scalar with a mass. If I put a little mass term here, I put an m squared phi squared. Let me not actually do that on the board. You would end up with this equation of motion where epsilon is m squared over h squared. Anyway, so I'm not really going to derive this. I mean, I think probably the right way to do it is just to recognize after making this change of variables that it's Bessel's differential equation. And there's an identity that says that the Hankel function at argument 3/2 happens to be of the special exponential type. Just wanted to say, you might get the impression if this appears out of nowhere that you're missing something easy if you try to solve it, but you're not. It's actually kind of hard.
K to the minus one half in front of this one, is that kind of relation?
Oh, actually, I didn't actually work out when I was making the notes the proportionality here. This doesn't have the right normalization, the 2k to the minus one half. The tau to the one half is just the way the Hankel function is defined. All right, so this is the equation of motion for the canonically normalized field psi. But of course, we also I'm going to write this down because it'll be sort of useful to refer to it. Since phi is just h tau times psi, then you would also have this expansion of the phi Heisenberg operators in terms of ladder operators, where the mode function u phi is h tau times the mode function for psi, which is h over 2k to the 3/2. It's 1 plus I. I think I may have lost a factor of I here, but that's OK. It's really just the absolute normalization that's defined. OK. And this is the form of the mode function that you'll find in books. So when people say the De Sitter mode function, they mean this. It's no longer constant as tau goes to minus infinity just because of this factor. But that's just the factor of tau that relates it to the canonically normalized field. OK, so that was all pretty straightforward to work out, except for that differential equation that I kind of chickened out on. So we can pause now and compute a really fundamental result, which is the power spectrum of the phi field at the end of inflation. So here's a fundamental result. Power spectrum P phi at the end of inflation. Well, let's just say at late times, because this isn't really inflation. This is a non-dynamical metric. So we just compute. I want to compute. There's a wave function for this field. The field starts out in the Bunch-Davies vacuum, and the modes excite as time goes on. I want to compute this expectation value. Let me put a k prime here. I wrote this in the Schrodinger picture, but of course, we actually computed in the Heisenberg picture, where I put the initial state and phi. And Heisenberg I is the operators. Okay, Now, if I plug in those Heisenberg operators and multiply everything out, then only the term in phi hat k prime, which contains the raising operator, survives. The lowering operator annihilates the vacuum. And likewise, only the term in, oh, this should be a dagger. Only the term phi dagger that contains the lowering operator survives. So let me just write down the terms that survive here. There's a u k tau a minus k dagger. And there's a u star. Sorry, no dagger. Let's get a dagger here. So I'll bring the u's in front. These are u phi's. And then when I have an A and an A dagger sandwiched between the vacuum, then that evaluates to this delta function, because that's the commutator. I just commute them, and then the vacuum gets annihilated. So that expectation value is just equal to their commutator. Plugging in the above formula for the mode function, u star u evaluates to this, and then I have the delta function. And when we talked about random fields, and so then at late times, late times here means tau equals zero, which is always makes formulas look a little less intuitive, but here's what you get. And when we talked about random fields, you'll recall that the power spectrum was defined when I took the expectation value of two Fourier modes of a field. That expectation value, by translation invariance, always contained a delta function, and the power spectrum was just defined to be the prefactor in front. So we've shown that at late times, fluctuations in this field will be produced with the following power spectrum. Now I'm going to interpret the physics that generates this power spectrum shortly. For now, I just want to note a few things. First off, it's scale invariant. It's the overall, it's a constant times 1 over h cubed, or 1 over k cubed. That kind of had to be true because the physics was scale invariant. One way to say it is that there are no, when we wrote the action down this way, there were no dimensionful parameters. If I had added a mass term, then I do have a parameter with mass. And the mode function changes. It's no longer 1 over k cubed. It's, exactly speaking, the square of a Hankel function. But roughly what that looks like is a little bit of a tilt away from scale invariance. This exponent would be k to the 3 minus epsilon. Although really that's just sort of a leading order approximation to the Hankel function, which is a messier function of k. Oh, wow. That's a tough question to answer in real time. Let me think. I think what probably happens, I'm not sure, but what probably happens if you were to couple this to electromagnetism by adding like an FB nu, right? This action is, this is a very tricky question. This action has a symmetry that the scalar field does it, namely it's conformally invariant. If I couple electromagnetism to a metric, then this action is actually invariant under a conformal transformation that sends g to any function of spacetime times g. It's not obvious, but if you work it out, the action changes by a total derivative. And so that means that one consequence of that is that if I just put electromagnetism on a de Sitter background, just put a U1 gauge field with no not coupled to a scalar, that it would not acquire fluctuations because it can't tell that there's this conformal factor sitting in front. It just thinks that it's a field in Minkowski and the expansion of the universe doesn't, it doesn't see the expansion of the universe, it doesn't generate fluctuations. And I think it should also be true that if I couple it somehow to this scalar, for example, by adding a coupling of the form, this form, because this doesn't acquire fluctuations, that it will not induce fluctuations in this. I think that's how, probably how it works. But I'd have to work it out to be sure. Generally speaking, you know, we sometimes say that all fields, if you put them on a de Sitter background, acquire these types of scale invariant fluctuations. But one class of exceptions are fields that are conformally invariant, like electromagnetism. Okay. It's scale invariant, and the size of the fluctuations is parametrically h. In the power spectrum, I have an h squared. That kind of had to be true because the scalar field here had units of mass, and the only mass scale here is the Hubble scale. So this is a really fundamental and important result that if I put a scalar field on de Sitter, that it gets scale invariant fluctuations whose size is order Hubble. All right. Now a little technical point. You might ask, did I really need to? The way that I worked this out was kind of indirect. I changed variables from phi to this canonically normalized field psi. And that was really just to make the choice of vacuum state clearer. But you might ask, to do the calculations, did we really need to canonically normalize? You might have instead just wrote down this solution on the top right board, to the Heisenberg picture equations of motion for phi, where u phi, you compute u phi instead of going through u psi. Here's the classical equation of motion for u phi. That's just what you get by varying this action with respect to phi to get the classical equation of motion. So why not just compute the mode function this way? By solving this equation. And the answer is you can. It's just not obvious how to normalize it at the end. So the problem is, how do you get the normalization? So if you solve this differential equation, you would, by the way, Mathematica does spit out the answer. I was sort of curious. If you feed this differential equation to Mathematica, it spits out the answer immediately. The question is, so you know that by solving this differential equation, or having Mathematica solve it for you, that the solution looks like this. You just don't know this normalizing factor A of k. So that appears to be the only reason to go through this intermediate step of switching to canonical normalization. But there's a more efficient way to do it. I like the canonical normalization because it just makes it really physically transparent what's going on. You're just writing every mode of the field as a time-dependent harmonic oscillator. And it's very just physically transparent why in Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics, a time-dependent harmonic oscillator that starts out time-independent gets excited. you don't really need to do this in practice. It's just more efficient calculationally to infer the normalization from the canonical commutation relation. Let's see. So the canonical commutator in Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics, the canonical commutator is xp. Commutator of x and p is always equal to I. And in field theory, the canonical commutator says that the commutator between a mode of the equal time commutator between a mode of phi and its associated conjugate momentum, let's call it p phi, always looks like I, and then when you go from quantum mechanics to field theory, you always have these delta functions lying around. Where the p here is the conjugate momentum field associated to phi, which you get from going back to the action. That's what you get by taking the partial derivative of the action, not the functional derivative, just the partial derivative of whatever quantity is under the integral sign. By differentiating with respect to phi dot, or in this case, phi prime, because I'm using conformal time. So just to write this out, this is how we do these calculations. And these types of calculations we do all the time. Like, there's this whole sort of industry of early universe physics where you think about possibilities for the early universe and do fancier and fancier versions of this calculation. So I just want to explain how we usually do the calculations, which is rather than switching to the canonical normalization, you just infer the A by the requirement that this canonical commutator is equal to I. And so the way that would work is you go back to the action and you just differentiate it with respect to phi prime. So that here is going to give, I have a little sign error. This should be minus 1/2 because of my metric signature, but this should have been plus 1/2. Okay, so for this action, the canonical for this choice of field coordinate phi, the conjugate momentum is phi prime over h tau squared. Canonical normalization, one way of thinking about it is that the conjugate momentum would just be psi prime with no 1 over h tau squared. Okay, so if you write that out, we want to get I is equal to the commutator of phi with its conjugate momentum, which is 1 over h tau squared I prime. Then here's what you get. Let's see, when I plug in the mode functions, so here I'll get let's do it in two steps. We'll bring the 1 over h tau squared in front. Let's see, so I'm going to get two terms, one where I had a u prime star, that was k prime. And then another term where I had a u minus k. With no star. And then a second term from flipping the order, which turns out to just be minus the complex conjugate of the first term. And so this gives, so I end up with a uk tau u prime star k tau minus u star k tau u prime for h tau squared. This is the type of determinant that we saw last time. These tend to come up a lot. So if you remember that if we pretend that I don't know the normalization yet, but I'm inferring it by this procedure, this gives, if you evaluate it, a star a times 1 plus ik tau k squared tau minus complex conjugate over h tau squared. Only this term will survive when I subtract the complex conjugate. And so I end up with an overall tau squared, which cancels, leaving behind h star star a times 2ik cubed over h squared. It's very important. It's a very important consistency check that the answer here comes out independent of time. The time dependence cancels out. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to normalize in a way so that the canonical commutation relation held for all times. And so we're supposed to get I out of the canonical commutator. So this means that a squared is equal to h over 2k cubed. So we've inferred the correct normalization to stick in front of the mode function. And this is, you know, the power spectrum that we get in the end. Okay, so the general prescription is you don't have to really think carefully about the vacuum state or find the canonically normalized change of variable. You just solve the differential equation, normalize the mode function by its canonical commutator, and this is where the quantum mechanics really creeps in. And then you have the solution to the free field theory, and you can compute whatever you want, for example, the power spectrum at late times. The point I want to make is this. Expressed that way, there's just a very simple, if I have some set of fluctuating fields in a de Sitter background, there's just this very simple prescription for calculating the fluctuations. And the prescription is so simple that it's kind of easy to forget that you're doing quantum mechanics. For example, you could get the same answer. You're just integrating the classical equation of motion and then squaring at the end to get the expectation value of phi squared. So it kind of looks like you would get the right answer if you just assumed that you had some Gaussian random fluctuations in the initial conditions and then just evolved a specific field configuration forward to late times. Strictly speaking, you know, what you're doing when you solve the differential equation for the mode function, you're not actually tracking the history of a specific field configuration. What you're doing is evolving the coefficient of an A dagger in the solution to a QFT. But it kind of looks like you're just evolving some initial classical randomness forward. So one comment is that, so this is why, like, when I first saw this type of calculation done, I didn't personally feel like I understood it. Because the procedure is so streamlined that it kind of obscures the physics. And I think it's sort of useful to go back. I mean, it seems kind of mysterious at the end. So it's kind of useful to go through the chain of steps. Like, you know, this is just a change of variable. And then once you get here, you're just sort of in this non-mysterious case where it's really easy to see why quantum mechanics induces fluctuations. In theories that have interesting deviations from Gaussian statistics, like if the Heisenberg picture equations of motion had nonlinear terms in them, then it's not true anymore that you can just evolve some initial classical randomness forward and get the right answer. Then you really have to go back to the quantum mechanics. You'll get the wrong answer if you try to do that, if you try to compute a three-point correlation function in a theory with nonlinear equations of motion, for example. Then it really has to look like you're doing quantum mechanics. Maybe one reason of saying why the physics doesn't look very quantum mechanical here is to say that for a quadratic path integral, the semi-classical approximation is exact. That's true even if there's explicit time dependence. So it's maybe not surprising in the end that we can do the calculation in a way that doesn't look like it has much quantum mechanics in it. Now, I do think this step of going through the canonical normalization also gives some insight into the physics. Let me write the equation of motion in two ways. So in the canonically normalized variable psi, it looks like this. Where you can think of equals zero. And let me write the equation of motion for phi like this. Just the same. Where I put the minus tau here just to remind you that tau is negative, so this friction term looks like it has the wrong sign. For some reason, I always get confused by that. So this kind of looks like just the ordinary equation for a harmonic oscillator with this Hubble friction term that turns on at late times, i.e. when tau is close to zero. And this one looks like the equation of motion for a harmonic oscillator with this big, time-dependent time dependence in the omega, which is kicking in at late times. Now, in the phi variable, the equation of motion is simple at early times. I.e. when tau is less than minus k to the minus 1. Then it just looks like the equation of motion for a free field in Minkowski. So somehow in the psi variable, the field doesn't feel the expansion of the universe until tau reaches some critical value. And in the phi variable, the equation of motion is simple at late times. At late times, this Hubble friction term is becoming huge. So what happens is that the field is just pinned. The solution to the equation of motion is phi is a constant. Pinned by Hubble friction. Now here's another way of thinking about this, which is a little more physical. So the quantity 1 over AH is the co-moving Hubble length. Or roughly speaking, it's the causal horizon. It's the co-moving distance between two points that can talk to each other causally in a Hubble time or less. Now in De Sitter, this evaluates in conformal time to minus tau, or in proper time to 1 over h e to the minus ht. So it's a decreasing function, not a slowly decreasing function either. Exponentially decreasing in proper time. So what happens with time is that I have this sort of co-moving distance of causal contact, the causal horizon. And then I have a mode, I'm analyzing the physics of a mode whose co-moving wavelength is fixed in co-moving coordinates, k to the minus 1. Now, at early times, I wrote the condition for early times this way before, but let me rewrite it in a maybe a slightly weirder looking way that just says that the wavelength of the mode is much less than the causal horizon. Then the mode just thinks that it's a free field in Minkowski. The oscillation, the physics of the mode, its harmonic motion is just determined by its wavelength, and it hasn't felt the expansion of the universe yet because the associated causal horizon is many times larger. So the mode just thinks it's a free field in Minkowski. And so, here's this sort of, mode that doesn't realize it lives in an expanding universe yet. And then all of a sudden, it switches over to this late time regime. Where now what's happening is that the wavelength of the mode is larger than the causal horizon. And so that means that the mode can't evolve, and that's just kind of true by causality. So it's frozen by, phi is frozen to a constant by causality. In the action, phi always appeared differentiated. So a trivial solution to the equation of motion is just phi equal to a constant. Just shifting by phi by a constant is a symmetry of the equations of motion. So there's no way for a mode, if its wavelength is much larger than the causal horizon, to know that it's a k mode that's supposed to be evolving, that has an equation of motion, as opposed to just some overall shift in the background value of phi in the universe. So the right way to think about this physics, the generation of quantum fluctuations, is that if you imagine this field that starts out just living and thinking that it's living in Minkowski, those Minkowski modes just have some quantum mechanical spread around the zero configuration, just like a harmonic oscillator, the ground state wave function has some spread. And then suddenly this causal horizon comes along and freezes those modes to some, they're stuck, they can't evolve away, to some classically random configuration. Now, one thing that we like to say is that the fluctuations become classical at late times. And so this is something that I think is kind of an interesting foundational question. One thing that's not true. So we talk about this is quantum mechanical randomness, but we talk about it as if it's classical randomness with some classical PDF, just given by the square of the wave function. Like when we do all of our cosmology in the late universe, we're just treating the initial fluctuations as if they were just some classical random variable, Gaussian random variable, with some power spectrum that we can compute. Now, one way that this could have been true is if the system ended up in a mixed state, right? Like a mixed state where the density matrix is diagonal in the field basis would behave, all expectation values would behave as if they were classical random variables. Now, that's not what happens in inflation, because we're still in a pure state. I mean, we didn't put in any decoherence or anything. We started in a pure state, the Bunch-Davies vacuum, and just evolved forward. That evolution of quantum mechanics is always unitary, so we have to end in a pure state. So the reason why fluctuations can be treated as classical random variables at the end of inflation is rather subtle. Now, one argument that you'll find in the, you'll sometimes see is the following. If you look at the equation, at the Heisenberg picture equation for phi dot, it's got u dots in it. Sorry, prime. And it is the case that for this mode function, the u phi, which is somewhere here, where did u phi go? I actually kind of lost it, but u phi is one plus ik tau, e to the minus ik tau. And you know, one property that this has is that if I differentiate with respect to tau, that I get the terms with no powers of tau cancel, and I get this. So in other words, phi prime, because its mode functions go to 0 as tau goes to 0 at late times. So one argument that you will sometimes see, like in books, is that the fluctuations become classical because the commutator between phi and phi prime goes to 0 at late times. So there's no all observables commute, which means that the situation is indistinguishable from classical mechanics just because of this tau. I don't think that's a very good argument, because you could always say, well, you know, that's just the factor of tau. This field phi always has a conjugate momentum whose commutator with phi is equal to I. And so this tau is really just the tau that relates the conjugate momentum, is just the normalization that relates the conjugate momentum to the field derivative. So if I had, for example, just considered the commutator of phi with tau to the minus 1 phi prime, that would approach a constant at late times. So there's a little more to the story than that. What does turn out to be true is that, so if you were allowed to build observables by taking combinations of phi and tau inverse phi prime, then you would discover the quantumness. But if you're only allowed to build observables out of phi and phi prime with no prefactor of tau to the minus 1 in front, then you can't. So to complete the argument, I think you need to show that the things that we measure in the universe today, like, say, the correlation function of galaxies, that the associated observables, you know, look like this and not this. If I write them down as Heisenberg picture operators during inflation and look at their how they behave as tau goes to 0, it's always phi and phi prime that appears, not phi and its conjugate momentum. And that requires a little more understanding of how these final conditions at the end of inflation link up to observables in the late universe. So this is the beginning of an argument that we'll complete when we understand that linkage better, when we talk about the adiabatic mode. But this is sort of how it, I think it's fun to talk about, so I couldn't resist saying a little bit about it now. Okay, well, I was going to start. So that's the massless test scalar in De Sitter. What I'm going to talk about next, and this won't take very long, is the case of a massless test scalar in FRW, where the expansion history is not exactly De Sitter; it's some like slow roll perturbation thereof. But since that's a new topic with only 2 minutes left to go, I'll just cut the lecture 2 minutes short and talk about it tomorrow. Any questions on this? Yeah.
The argument that this commutator, the rescaled commutator phi and phi prime divided by tau is constant. Are you trying to say that these fluctuations are still inherently quantum in nature, even at late times?
Strictly speaking, it is a pure state. A more concrete way of saying it is this. that suppose that you had in like n-dimensional Schrodinger quantum mechanics, I had some wave function psi in n dimensions, and I'm allowed to make repeated observations of the wave function, do repeated experiments, but for some reason, I'm only allowed to measure expectation values of observables that are built out of x hats. I'm not ever allowed to look at any observables that have p hat in them. So just some operator which is built out of x hats. Then any expectation value that I compute can always be written in the position space basis as the integral of psi star psi times this operator O. And so the situation is indistinguishable from a classical random PDF, a classical random variable with PDF psi star psi. For any expectation value that I want to compute quantum mechanically, I would get the same answer if I just assumed that I had a classical random variable with this PDF and computed an ordinary expectation value. Now, this wouldn't be true anymore if you were allowed to build operators out of X and P. Those don't commute, and you can discover the randomness, you know, even in some really heavy-handed way. You might be able to violate a Bell inequality or something. And this is roughly what happens in the universe, you know, in the real universe, is that all the observables that we actually measure today are like this. If you were to take an observable that we measure today and evolve it back into the early universe, then you would find something. Well, one way to say it is that all of the p's that appear are suppressed by powers of tau, just end up being suppressed by powers of tau. And another way to say it is that you just, you know, they sort of, the observables sort of naturally arise as combinations of phi and phi prime, not combinations of phi and its conjugate momentum. But this is a really non-obvious statement. We have to show it. We need to understand how to link observables today back into this early universe picture.
But this would only be true if that is the only thing happening in MDS, right? There are matter fields and all kinds of stuff sitting around.
Yeah, right.
Doesn't necessarily lead to decoherence that destroys the quantum nature anyway.
Oh, that's another thing that might happen. And yeah, you know, people do write papers on that. Like decoherence mechanisms. You know, for example, if you have a little bit of nonlinearity in the equations, then you couple the modes that you do measure to modes on, say, smaller scales that you never measure. When you trace those modes out, you get something that's more like a mixed state. But at least as far as I can tell, even if you didn't have any decoherence mechanism, just the time dependence of the operators that you actually get to measure would imply that the statistics look classical. Now, another important comment that I should make is that this discussion is actually really specific to single field inflation. I had thought it was true. I had thought that there would be some sort of theorem that said that you could never violate a Bell inequality in any model of inflation, including multi-field models. But there was actually a paper like 6 months or so ago by Maldacena, which is called A Bell Inequality Violating Model of Inflation, that provides a counterexample. But the model is super weird. It has to have like axions and non-abelian gauge groups and all of this. Like the simplest model that seems to work contains all of these strange ingredients. And so a question that I don't know the answer to. To be totally honest, I don't understand that paper very well. I don't understand it in a sort of simple way. So a question that I was kind of wondering about is what are the conditions on a model of inflation that will imply that the statistics are classical even in the absence of any decoherence mechanism? I think that's an open question. I don't know the answer.